The next speaker you will be hearing from is Bill Harlan from ERI, and Bill is phenomenal, and you will totally enjoy his session. Bill, it's all yours.
Hi. I haven't addressed this group since, I think the last time I was talking about combining HD digital signals with analog using separate antennas, so it's been quite a while. We're going to talk about something completely different than, ERI, everyone I'm sure knows we manufacture antennas, transmission line filters, but another big part of our business is doing towers. And because of that, we spend a lot of time dealing with the standards that cover not only the design of the tower, but also the engineering standards associated with the erection and alteration and maintenance of the structure, and also the safety practices that govern the construction practices that are used in erection and tower alteration. And so what we're going to talk about are the standards associated with that. There is in process right now, there will be all new revisions of every one of those major standards. Two of the three are becoming effective on January 1st of 2024. And the final construction standard is probably going to be adopted and approved before the end of the year. So a lot of where this formalizing the process of designing and erecting towers started was in 2008, the head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration actually declared in a talk given to an industry group, after tower climbers who were rushing to meet the deadlines AT&T put on them to build out the network in 2008. At the end of that year, AT&T crews, because of a lack of supervision and lack of safety standards, 11 climbers died in a single year. And that was more than all other cellular buildouts combined. And at that, his final statement was he declared working on towers to be the deadliest job in America. And since then, there's been a concerted effort across industry and government to formalize and strengthen and increase the professionalism in every aspect of vertical real estate construction. So when we're talking about the standards that are involved, the linchpin standard is the TIA 222 standard. The current standard is the H revision. I will be effective January 1. The differences between H and I are limited, and we'll get into why they're changing. That standard, and it's important to keep this date in mind, was actually adopted in 2016. And bear in mind that normally for these kinds of standards, the revision dates are usually a decade apart. So this is not very long since the last revision. The 322 standard that's the standard, the engineering standard that's applied to the work of erecting or altering or doing maintenance on a tower. So that has to do with the engineering involved in rigging plans or doing tower reinforcement. And then what goes back is after all of the changes are made, the tower, after it's altered, is re-examined under the 222 standard to see it, to analyze it as it stands. And then finally, the 1048 standard is the construction standard. And that's what's used by the people who add the general contractors and their subcontractors to govern the practices and procedures that are used to erect the tower, install new antennas, make repairs, do installations, add reinforcement. So you've got these standards, the three standards that were all adopted in 2016 or 2017. And what's driving this was in 2022, the American Society of Civil Engineers, they have their document, ASCE, and this is version 7. And what that document contains is the standards that underlie all of the materials considerations that are used by all the other standards to determine steel strength, concrete construction, concrete strength. These flow out into all of the ASTM and ANSI standards that all of these other standards, 222, 322, and 1048, are built on. And so every time when the ASCE standard was modified, that rolled through and causes a change to everything else that's laid up above it. Now, the things that happen in ASCE 7, the most important is we have better computer models, better weather data to cover everything from hurricanes to tornadoes, to windstorms, to erosion, and regardless of politics, climate change-driven factors, whatever. And they took all these factors and moved those into the ice maps and wind maps that drive all of the construction classes for designing towers. And then on top of that, rather than making this a subscription service, the ASCE actually created an online hazard tool, which is free of charge, that anyone can access, that can put in their location and can get the hazards from the ASCE standard for that location. And that's an online tool, and I know the PDF of the presentation will be posted, and that link is active to that site. So, the H standard, one of the big things it did was it took the standards, the risk category standards, which are really the foundation for all of the parameters that lay on top of how you're going to design a tower for a particular site. You have the three classes from the prior standards. Class 1, which would be your ham radio tower or your 30-foot TV antenna receive tower. A tower that is not critical to public safety communications, the chances of loss of life from its failure are very minimal, and it's normally for non-commercial purposes. Class 2 structure, that applies to virtually all commercial structures, including broadcast. And those are structures that are important from a communication standpoint, but if they're used for a public safety requirement, they're usually part of a redundant system as opposed to a non-redundant system. Then when you get into class 3 structures, those are non-redundant public safety systems. Most of those are DOD or federal government. Usually local and county and state public safety commission systems have backup and alternative methods, so you have alternate sites and redundancy built into the system. The H standard added class 4, and class 4 is a structure that is absolutely critical in terms of maintaining communications, or it's built in a location where there is a significant hazard that could lead to a loss of human life. The easiest example is you put a tower on top of the containment building of a nuclear power reactor. And then when the H standard came along, this remains the same in I, wind speeds went from being a 3-second gust to ultimate wind speeds. And you have now, rather than an application factor for the risk category, you have separate ice and wind speed maps for each class of risk category, class of structure. And by changing from nominal wind speed to the ultimate wind speed, this just gives you an example. If you analyzed a site under Rev G at a 90 mile an hour nominal wind speed, if that had a 114 mile an hour wind speed, it would be a nominal wind speed, or ultimate wind speed would translate back to 90 the way that the ice maps work. And this was the idea was to simplify it for the computer programs so that they didn't have to make all these calculations. In general, when they moved from Rev G to Rev H, wind speeds decreased by 10% for most of the country. And the only places it really increased was in Central Florida, where it went up by 5 to 10%. Second factor is surface roughness. Surface roughness B is most locations where you find broadcast towers. They're urban and suburban areas, wooded areas, or other terrain where you got numerous closely spaced structures to break up constant wind speeds. When you get into roughness C, that's open terrain, a lot of scattered objects. So you're talking grasslands, rural areas, athletic fields. And then roughness D is coasts, salt flats, places that are smooth with virtually no obstructions. Under Rev G, exposure C was applied to hurricane coasts. Exposure D adds a 10 to 15% higher exposure, and that's generally what's applied in most hurricane coasts. One thing that was not included in G, which is in H and I, is there is a wind pressure decrease with elevation. So as you go up, air density falls. Therefore, the amount of pressure the wind puts on a structure at a given speed is reduced. So in Chicago, you get a 2% reduction, 17% in Denver, 7% in Las Vegas, 4% in Atlanta and Phoenix. It also added topographic factors. So if you got a steep hill, it uses a speed up factor at the top of the hill. And in Rev H, there's a process where if you're in a unique wind zone, you can use site specific topographical features to arrive at your own wind speed for that location. And then there's a rooftop wind speed factor, and that applies to roofs on buildings that are isolated or more than 50 feet taller than all of the structures surrounding it. So we move out of 222 and into 322 in ANSI 1048. The 322 standard is the engineering standard, as I said, and that correlates back to the design criteria for the installation and maintenance and alteration of the structure. And that drives the construction practices that are used in A1048. The criteria for safety and construction and demolition, and it's a contractor's standard, so it does address means and method. And where the parts of these came from was these were preceded by something called the A1019A standard, which was the standard that was generated following revision F to cover using gin poles to erect a tower. And that was the first draft of that, and then moved on to more sophisticated procedures in 1048. So you've got 322 and 1048, and they built on the 1019A standard, but they expanded and focused content on a greater understanding, and the idea was to improve communications between engineers and contractors when planning and assessing construction. You have a general conformance to minimum construction requirements, which were put out in 1019A, but they were all consolidated in the 10.48 standard. And when they're utilized properly, it does reduce the cost and risks in construction when you're erecting a new tower or making major alterations. So in these two, in the 1048 general contractor standard, there are four classes of special or identified individuals involved in a construction project. For all construction projects, a general contractor has to employ a competent rigger. And their focus is they're on site, they identify hazards, take corrective measures, and do what's necessary to implement the necessary construction means and methods. For a class three and class four construction, and I'll get into what these classes are and what drives them, there must be a qualified person that is designated and qualified to develop the rigging plan and to communicate construction requirements to all the stakeholders in the project. and a Class 4 construction project, the general contractor has to have a qualified person to assist in developing a rigging plan and involve a qualified engineer to assess the supporting structure during construction. So we require a competent rigger for all classes. They must be on site. They communicate directly with a qualified person. And the qualified person is only used in class three and class four construction projects. And there are very few broadcast projects that are not class three or class four. And they may be on site or they could be in the office. And if the person is properly qualified, the same person can fill any of these roles. And often in a class three or four structure, the qualified person and the competent rigger are the same person. The qualified person is the one that communicates with a qualified engineer. So the roles and responsibilities of engineering. So the term engineer of record. The engineer of record is the structural engineer who is the one that seals the tower drawings that says this structure, either as built or as it stands, is correct and safe and meets codes in its completed state. So they are not part of the construction or 322 scope of work. They're part of determining whether the structure before it is modified and after it is modified meets code. The qualified engineer is a registered professional or an engineer, but he is knowledgeable, or she is knowledgeable and experienced in communication structures and can understand a rigging plan and the scope of work and is responsible for analyzing the structure's strength and stability, including the construction loads. So it's doing the engineering to make sure that rigging the tower and putting the gin pole and lifting the channel 8 top mount TV antenna to the tower top won't bring it down. And the supervising engineer accepts responsibilities as defined as the qualified engineer and shares those responsibilities with the qualified person. So the idea is here to standardize the common terminology so that we establish all the key stakeholder titles, responsibilities, we standardize the terminology, the common equipment, components in telecommunication structures. It also has, the standard includes a full set of standard set of notations and symbols and consistency in load charts and construction plans. So the construction class determines the minimum personnel which must be engaged in their development and review and the implementation of the rigging plan. So in short, a rigging plan is required in any tower construction project. 10.48 requires that. And this includes installation, decommissioning, adding equipment pertinences, structural modifications, installation, decommissioning, foundation installation and modification, and any construction activity involving a telecommunication structure. And A1048 provides four construction classes, and the construction classes are determined by the lifted load, the categorized potential impact to the supporting structure, the personnel involved in the planning and implementation, and the varying levels of documentation and involvement of the project stakeholders. Rigging plans for class two, three, and four construction must be documented. Lifting from an adjacent tower, then those loads don't count. But the most important thing is in a class one that what you're doing won't adversely impact the strength or stability of the structure. And the statement of work can include any special custom or unique construction methods. And it can be prepared by either a competent rigger or a qualified person. Class two rigging plans, the gross lift load can't exceed 500 pounds. And again, cranes and other lifting systems are included. Again, there can't be an adverse impact on the structure. And again, a qualified person or a competent rigger can prepare that plan. Class 3, this is what you'll usually at least deal with, is a gross lift load that doesn't exceed 2,000 pounds. It applies to all new structure and foundation construction where that lift limit is not exceeded. All construction activities involving cranes or lifting devices not attached to the structure are also included in Class 3 or Class 4, depending on the lifting load. And then the construction activity cannot adversely impact the strength, the stability of the structure, and it requires preparation by a minimum of a competent rigger and a qualified person. We usually involve a qualified engineer as well. And the Class 4 rigging plan, that's the large bolt-together tower or top-mounted TV antenna generally. So you've got a planned lift exceeding 2,000 pounds. Usually you have a rigging system that's directly attached to the structure. It may involve removal of structure members, replacing hog rods or diagonals or cross pieces and doing a tower reinforcement. You have removal of unique appurtenances. You got a big old Cassegrain microwave antenna on the side of the tower, so removing that is generally considered a special or unique appurtenance. Often it uses a statement of work that has infrequent construction methods or specially engineered lifts, and any tower decommissioning or demolition is a Class 4 project. So they're provided by a competent rigger and a qualified person with a qualified engineer. I did want to mention Nate. They now call themselves the Communications Infrastructure Association. They have a section on their website that is open, available to everyone, not just members. It's got a lot of free templates, particularly checklists for evaluating qualified contractors. It's got a lot of resources for tower owners on vetting people who are going to work on their tower, forms and things to make sure that your contractors and their subcontractors are paying attention to. Yeah, it's very useful, and I'd urge you all to check it out because the asset you're dealing with is often worth a high five-digit or six-digit amount of money. And from there, we're going to go into qualified contractor requirements. The first thing is, does the contractor have insurance coverage to cover the project? And often, is it written by an insurance company that is authorized to do business in the state where the project is located? This is a typical certificate of commercial liability insurance. So it includes commercial liability, automobile liability, workman's compensation and employer liability, and we do some large projects, so we also have excess liability riders that are usually part of our insurance certificates. Anytime you have any work done on your structure or any building you own or anywhere on your property, you should get a certificate of insurance from the contractor with your company as a named additional insured. Does the contractor have the necessary experience? Does the contractor have a written health and safety plan, a drug and alcohol policy, new employee safety orientation, technician certifications, site safety assessment forms and how to do them, training, documentation, all the required OSHA record keeping? And if he's going to do personnel hoisting, does he have the 81048 procedure and that process documented as a part of his safety system? Require that the competent person be on site anytime work is being performed. Don't let them get the job started and then phone it in from there. It needs to be someone who is there. OSHA requires it. It's got to have someone on site who's identifying existing hazards or predictable hazard as the work is being performed. And all of these things, any conditions like that, should be already documented before any work begins. And then, of course, personnel requirements. I mean, does everybody have a hard hat? Does it have a chin strap if they're going to climb on the tower? And everyone on site should wear a hard hat whenever you're there, whenever your general manager there is there, whatever. Everybody should have a hard hat while there's people above you. And does the crew include at least one CPR, first aid, and rescue trained climber as a member of the crew? We always have two, because what happens if the one you've got trained gets hurt? Crew members, do they have the right kind of clothing? Do they have eye protection, hand protection, hearing protection if that's required? Do they have safety glasses if they have to grind on something? Are all those things there? And more importantly, are all those items inspected as part of the safety meeting in the morning every day? Anybody who's climbing, they have to have a full body harness. And the full body harness should include dual 6-foot shock absorbing lanyards. And they are required for 100% tie off. And remember, work positioning hooks are not fall protection equipment. So it's gotta be a couple lanyards. The work positioning protection is a completely different part of the rigging on the harness. The site hazardous analysis should be done prior to the work beginning or even the crew showing up on site, ideally. And that is an evaluation that's done on site by either the competent rigger or qualified person, depending on the construction class. And it's part of the OSHA requirement for any work that's done. So you've got to identify any danger that threatens to harm employees or unsafe workplace conditions or practices that could cause injuries or illness or harm to employees. To identify hazards in the worst place, the contractor should use a systematic approach. There are various strategies that can be used, but it really depends on the type of work. Of course, the big thing, particularly when you're lifting things up, is overhead electrical wires. You'll see this on highway construction sites all the time. The overhead wire needs to be identified. And it requires an electrical safety plan. OSHA requires that, so if something does go wrong, you know who to contact that turned the power off, and you need to have all the appropriate identification and marking. The crew should have material safety data sheets for any chemicals or other items they have with them. That's an OSHA requirement, so any chemical products, anything that possesses a chemical burn hazard, and it should be in a binder that's easily identified, and everybody should know where it is. You should always have proper safety signs. The appropriate safety signs are around the perimeter of the job, and also specialized signs right at the location of a particular hazard. They should always warn of any hazard before you approach it, not as you approach it or after you approach it. This one is, it's surprising how often this is overlooked. An emergency and rescue plan. Before anybody starts work, there needs to be a document that says where the hospital is, how to call an ambulance, how to get a hold of the sheriff or local police, and how everybody communicates with each other on the site. There should be an RF safety plan as part of this. There should be a checklist of the rescue equipment and written rescue procedures and where they are. The identification of the competent rescue climber or climbers. And just as a note of caution, if you're there and somebody does get hurt, make sure that somebody calls 911 before they start crawling up a tower and trying to rescue somebody in case they need to be rescued. There also should be accident report forms. This is required for the OSHA 300 logs. These are often the forms, in our case, what we use is we have a call-in service where our crews just call a telephone number and we pay a service that actually does the emergency data form and forwards that to our human resources and the appropriate supervisors. Just to make sure that that's done and not lost and archived and cataloged and made part of our OSHA 300 logs. Make sure the supervisor has the forms or the number that needs to be called available, and that should, of course, be part of the original or the safety plan. You should also, you should also have maps and directions to the hospital and numbers for emergency services. Then these should be updated and accurate. And that should include things like natural gas pipeline location services, those sorts of things. OSHA does allow hoisting of personnel. However, there are compliance guidelines that must be adhered to. The hoist operator must have the proper training. There must be a pre-lift meeting before personnel are hoisted. The equipment needs to be man-rated. It needs to be rated for lifting people, along with the man baskets and whatever else is being used to perform that work. There needs to be a trial lift, and that needs to be documented. There are maximum ascent and descent speeds, which should also be included and documented. There is a maximum number of personnel per lift, and that needs to be documented, and there are communications and weather restrictions associated with that activity. Site housekeeping. OSHA requires employers to be aware of and keep sites free of potential hazards. So the debris should be cleaned up. There should be waste containers for debris. If the project is going to last multiple weeks, there should be a plan where the bins are emptied at a regular interval or call out when they're reaching near full. They're all tripping hazards, and of course there are many items that turn into debris that are combustible. So this just a quick checklist. You can also get this a more suitable document for your clipboard from the NATE site. The benchmarks are the appropriate insurance, experience and references and capability to work, a written safety program, regular safety audits, a site-specific safety plan, and a competent person on site anytime work is being performed. The employees should be appropriate and have documented training. They should be physically able to meet the job demands. Every one of them should be drug tested. Conduct a hazard assessment and maintain good housekeeping on job site. Provide an orientation and awareness program for new hires. We don't just send somebody out after we hire them the day after to climb a 500-foot tower. They actually have to go through a training program. Maintain written documentation on all of the training as required. We keep that file on every single person, and there's also an annual retraining for everybody. We stand down between Christmas and New Year's specifically for that. Agree that any subcontractors hired will meet all the same contractor requirements and make sure their insurance certificate rolls through to you. Adhere to the provisions of OSHA Directive CPL 2-136 and require that the OSHA logs be maintained, and it's a good idea to check to see if the contractor has OSHA logs going back 2 years, because that's what OSHA requirements provide. One thing that went into H, this has always been part of our installation documentation and maintenance documentation. In 222H, they added maintenance and condition assessment as part of recommendations included in the standard. And the fact that it's included in the standard is important, because since it is part of the standard, even though it's just a recommendation, this is an item that your insurance carrier, if you have a problem, a tower falls down because of poor maintenance, this is something they can point to as an item that might be construed as negligence. So the rules are that a guide mast needs to have an assessment and inspection on a 3-year interval. And self-supporting structures, they relax that to 5. But they also say after a severe wind or ice storm or severe seismic event or other extreme condition, a flood, there should be an inspection and assessment of the structure. And it also recommends shorter intervals for Category 3 and Category 4 structures. And of course, coastal regions, if you're on the Houston coast and you're having an acid bath in the atmosphere, that's always a good idea. And if you've got an AM site in East St. Louis where it's routinely vandalized, that's also something else you should probably look at more frequently. Severe unloading conditions can be interpreted to be any condition that subjects the tower or supported equipment to high or unusual stresses. So straight line wind events, things like that. If all the cornfields are laying down, you might want to look at your tower. Galloping guy wires, a seismic action, big ice storm, major, and also following a major addition. If you're going to take off one top mounted TV antenna and put on another top mounted TV antenna, it's probably a good idea a year later to go take a look at it, even if it's not due for the following year. Also, if the tower is equipped with an elevator or an equipment hoist, there is usually a whole slew of additional state or local regulations associated with that. It's reached the point where we really are highly resistant to putting an elevator in the tower. I personally experienced a 2.5-year-old ordeal with the Iowa Department of Labor over two of those. And of course, the maintenance condition, we have a whole work procedure and process and document. First, the structure condition, you damaged members, loose members, missing members, loose and missing bolts or nuts, visible cracks, pole flange or base plate flange cracks. And it's a good idea to record the temperature, wind speed, direction, and any other environmental conditions when the inspection's being made. How's the paint or galvanizing, or rust or corrosion? Is the color marking something similar to what the FAA, ICAO color markings are supposed to be? And are there any places where you got water collecting or drain holes that aren't draining, which is a potential for howling leg members to be split from freezing? And of course, the lighting components externally should be checked. The conduit junction boxes, are they weather tight? Are the drain and vent openings unobstructed? Is the wiring in good condition? Are the lenses in good condition? Do the controllers work? And are there obstructions? Did somebody put a brand new microwave dish in front of a mid-level beacon? Those sorts of things. And then assessing the ground connections for corrosion actually being connected, and are the lightning rods if the tower is equipped. Just as a note, the standard does not require lightning rods. Lightning rods are generally for the protection of appurtenances on the tower or the tower lighting system, but they are actually not part of the tower standard. Antennas and mounts should be looked at. Do microwave dishes have their proper tiebacks? Is there damage to the supporting structure, that is the mounts that are on the leg to hold the dish? Are there defects, deformations, loose or missing hardware? And if it's a Teglar radome, is it intact or does it have half of it gone or a big strip falling out? The feed line condition, are all the hangers there? Are all the proper flanges seated? Are there all the nuts and bolts in every flange? Are the hangers secured to the structure? Are the hoisting grips secured to the structure? And then if you've got platforms or ice shields or ladders, what condition are they in? Again, loose and missing hardware, and are they properly secured to the structure? And for base insulated towers, what's the condition of the base insulator? You got any cracking, chipping? Is the insulator compromised somehow with a whole streak of paint or something growing across it? Or is it delaminating, or are you getting UV degradation? Guy wires, look at turnbuckles. Are the guys, do you have fraying on the guy wires themselves? are the cable thimbles all there, or the ice clips there, or all the end fittings and dead grips, poured sockets, inspect the tension rods and the anchor rods and the welded flange plates for fatigue and cracks. And then on a guide tower, measure the guide tensions. Again, be sure that's as critical. Record the temperature, wind speed, and wind direction. And in the case of the foundation, do you have some settlement? Is the earth cracks, erosion, site condition, standing water? And the anchorage condition, top and bottom plates, concrete condition, cracking, spalling, honeycombing, low spots that are collecting moisture, all these should be addressed. And then the guide mast, is there any settlement in the guy anchors? Corrosion control, anchor heads, are they all above grade in vegetation? And then checking the structure's plumb and twist. We suggest that you do a quarterly inspection, and by that we don't mean a climbing inspection, we mean something done with visually at the site, just to make sure every quarter that walk around the site, is there hardware laying on the ground? It's a good idea to use a transit scope or a camera with a telephoto lens or a set of binoculars just to run up and down the shaft and make sure everything's there where it's supposed to be. Just visually inspecting, even around the ground, is a good idea. Once a quarter. It used to be something we included in our suggestions for maintaining the tower. And the lighting system inspection should include making sure every light level works, all of the electrical systems work, and that requirement, of course, is an FCC and an FAA requirement. Guy dampers, the high-frequency dampers, are they all there? And then if the tower's equipped with lowest frequency snubbers, are all those foundations in good condition? Are the pulleys moving freely if it's a sandbag damper? Or are the sandbags still filled with sand? And then, of course, as I mentioned previously, the tower and elevator and equipment hoist should be visually inspected, not necessarily operated or climbed. And that's what I have. If there's any questions, it looks like we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Oh, in that case, thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh.
We got one from the tech, should be fairly quick. Can you explain galloping guy wires?
Galloping guy wires. One of our favorite subjects. I've got some good video on those. I should have brought some. Mark over here, too. If the guy wire tensions are low, then if you get a wind event at a particular wind speed, the wires will actually gallop. That is, they will move up and down, and it can bring a tower down. And that's what low-frequency snubbers are for, is to prevent guy wire galloping. The dumbbells that are at the top of the guy wire, those are for high-frequency dampening. Guy wire galloping, the bat wing that went down in Lubbock, Texas, so this has been 25 years ago, that was guy wire galloping because the neighbors complained about it being awakened in the middle of the night during a thunderstorm because the guy wires were galloping up and down. And so that's what that is. Yeah, Mark.
Okay.
Turn it on.
Is it on? Great. I agree with what you're doing here, but it occurs to me that this could double the cost of tower work nowadays with all these extra inspections.
Not quite double it, but what's happened is you've got to deal with more professional people, and a lot of this work really has to do, and where the big money gets in is when you're doing a big reinforcement. And or making a big tower change. It's not as onerous as you would think. It's just professionalizing and making sure a certain process is followed. And the end game is to save money for the customer, the contractor, and to keep everybody safe. Thank you very much.
Just one more. Aren't quarterly tower inspections required by the FCC?
The FCC requires you to quarterly inspect your lights. They don't require you to quarterly inspect the tower.